Olympic number 2. On September 30, 1938, the famous agreement at Munich was reached, which was then hailed by British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain as assuring peace in our time. For years, the British and French had watched Hitler's Germany as it rearmed to the teeth, and the only response had been a policy of appeasement. As a result, at Munich, they were negotiating from a position of weakness, and to further appease Hitler, they agreed to the partition of a country that was not even party to the negotiations, Czechoslovakia. But as we all know, the Munich Agreement did not bring peace in our time. Less than 2 years after Munich, on July 10, 1940, the skies over Britain suddenly filled with Hitler's bombers, and the Battle of Britain had begun. The lightning warfare that had paralyzed and crushed other victims was now to smash Britain as well, or so it seemed. Through the summer and autumn of 1940, the world watched for the invasion of Britain to be launched across the English Channel, but the invasion never came. The world watched with growing astonishment as the Spitfires of the Royal Air Force ruined attack after attack by Göring's Air Armada. For the British, in spite of public pronouncements about peace in our time, had learned the lesson of Munich well, and during the short breathing space that followed, the British government had secretly launched a crash program to prepare for the fight for survival that was looming ahead. We in America, who had not yet experienced the horrors of war on our own soil, have had our survival instinct lulled to sleep by propaganda and distractions of all kinds, but not so Great Britain. Some months ago, I revealed that of all the nations of the free world, only Great Britain is engaging in a sustained, determined effort to stave off military attack by the Soviet Union to the best of her ability. And, my friends, this is still true, because the lessons of the past are not lost on the British. On June 18, 1940, Sir Winston Churchill spoke in the House of Commons to declare that the British were determined to fight rather than surrender, whatever the odds. And that same spirit is quietly being rekindled in Britain today. An internal struggle within the British government is going on between those with this view and others, some of them very powerful, who are Rockefeller agents, striving to induce Britain to lie down and die. But so far, there are still enough patriots in the British government to carry the day. When I recorded audio letter number 15 1 year ago in August 1976, I revealed the navigational coordinates of 64 newly planted Soviet underwater-launched nuclear missiles in the territorial waters of the countries around the world. At that time, Soviet missiles were planted more densely around the British Isles than anywhere else on Earth, because the Soviet Union views England like a giant aircraft carrier that must be sunk to help free the Soviet Navy to explode into the Atlantic unhampered when war comes. The importance of this to the Soviet Union was illustrated the following month in late September 1976. As I reported in audio letter number 16 for that month, the Soviet Union carried out a massive, extremely rapid deployment of submarines into attack positions along our east, west, and Gulf coasts late in September, involving at least 142 submarines. This took place only a matter of days after I had met for well over an hour at the Pentagon with General George S. Brown, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to discuss the growing Soviet underwater missile crisis with him. The purpose of the massive deployment of Soviet naval power along our shores was a power play to prevent the United States Navy from being allowed to capture a Soviet missile-laying mini-sub that was then trapped in Chesapeake Bay. And as I reported the following month in audio letter number 17, it worked. The very idea that the Soviet Union is capable of such rapid, massive, and well-coordinated deployments of its huge submarine fleet seems unbelievable to many. And many therefore ignored what I revealed last September about this incident. But just 4 weeks ago, on July 29, 1977, NATO intelligence sources in Brussels revealed a recent naval exercise by the Soviet Union that once again exhibited the same capability to fill the oceans with overwhelming numbers of submarines. According to news dispatched by the British Reuters News Service, quote, 89 Soviet submarines swarmed into the Atlantic Ocean recently in a massive show of naval strength that stretched NATO surveillance forces to their limits, NATO intelligence sources revealed yesterday. More Soviet submarines were deployed between North America and Europe than ever before, said one senior intelligence officer. And, my friends, this statement is true. Since the 142 submarines that threatened the United States last September were not all in the Atlantic. Many were in the Gulf of Mexico and the Pacific. Quoting the Reuters dispatch again, American and British submarines, which usually trail Soviet submarines, were unable to cope with the rush, and NATO had to resort to other, less effective means to keep track of many of the boats. Unquote. Another quote, the submarines were accompanied by a large force of surface warships, including the aircraft carrier Kiev, which bears vertical takeoff and landing jet fighters. Long-range warplanes, including some of the 400 supersonic backfire bombers that the Russians now operate, flew over the maneuvering fleet from their bases in the Murmansk area, the sources said, unquote. Another quote, NATO views the deployment of the Soviet submarine fleet to sea as one of its most important warning signs that a conflict is about to begin, unquote. That, my friends, is why the stationing of so many Soviet submarines in attack positions around the United States was so ominous last September. Notice who was responsible for letting the public know about this latest huge Soviet naval exercise. Not anyone in the United States government, but NATO authorities in Europe. To quote one more line from the Reuters dispatch, which was omitted in the New York Times, quote, the United States Defense Department had no comment on the story, unquote. America's real rulers do not want us to know even about Soviet practice exercises as huge as the one in April 1977, much less the occurrence of actual confrontations like the one I told you about last September. Great Britain is acutely aware of all of these things. She is aware of the increasing handicaps that plague the European part of the NATO alliance. And she's finding out that the United States can no longer be depended upon for help in time of crisis. She is determined not to be sunk by the Soviet Union. First, the British have been taking an objective new look at the cold, hard facts of their circumstances. A month ago, on July 26, 1977, the Defense Committee of Parliament made public a report that spelled out in clear terms a number of important measures needing revision and upgrading in Britain's defense posture. And the report begins by discarding the comforting but unrealistic idea that heightened tensions would always provide an advance warning before any Soviet attack. Instead, they're coming to grips with the need to be prepared for a more likely event of a surprise attack. The Parliament Committee also warned of the threat a Soviet mine laying in the English Channel and the North Atlantic. Meanwhile, spurred on by the Soviet underwater missile crisis for a full year now, the British have developed a new mine-detecting sonar equipment to enable underwater missiles and mines to be detected. For several months now, The Royal Navy has been using this highly secret new equipment built by the Plessy Company of England to keep British waters cleared of Soviet missiles and bombs without depending any longer on the intelligence tips I was relaying to them earlier. I would not mention this now except that a recent incident occurred that has already compromised this vital new equipment to Soviet agents. Recently, the West German Navy, eager to begin using this same equipment to start clearing their own coastal waters of Soviet missiles, was to receive a shipment of the highly classified equipment from the Plessy Company. But a Soviet agent in Britain achieved a remarkable feat of espionage by bringing about a misrouting of this equipment on an East German ship. By the time this vital equipment finally arrived, overdue and damaged, it had been thoroughly studied and photographed by Soviet technical experts. As a result, the Soviet Union may now be able to find ways to defeat even the sophisticated new British sonar, just as they are already able to defeat American seabed sonar defenses in order to plant missiles in our waters. Despite this setback, the British are working quietly but quickly to prepare to go it alone, if need be, when war comes, even though they realize that they would not be able to hold out indefinitely under those conditions. Unlike the United States, Britain is beefing up its surveillance of spies. Defense installations are being hardened and camouflaged, and the RAF is in the process of going underground, just as the Soviet Union has already done. The British government now knows, privately, that Great Britain has already been deserted by the outlaw government of the United States. And in late last month, on July 27, 1977, the British deserted the floundering United States dollar. For a generation and more, the pound sterling and the dollar have been linked together in an unofficial way, but no more. The Bank of England announced it would no longer be required to support the dollar in the international monetary float. And since that time, British reserves of gold and currency have risen substantially, strengthening the pound, while the American dollar has been sinking in international currency markets. It may be that the British ship of state will, in the end, be unable to stay afloat through the storm of all-out nuclear war. But so far, the British still prefer to take that risk rather than scuttling their own ship as the United States government under Rockefeller control is now doing. Topic number three. My friends, the nuclear mining of America's inland lakes and rivers has now been completed without incident by Soviet agents, thanks to their protection from harassment by Rockefeller agents in the federal government. At least three different models of small hydrogen bombs have been utilized so far by Soviet agents in this project. One is a design which has been in use for the greater part of a decade, as bombs were planted during construction of certain major dams and water projects. A second type, oval in shape, 17 inches in diameter and 34 inches in length, has been deployed very widely throughout the United States in recent months. It weighs several hundred pounds, and handling is therefore a problem, with the result that great care is always taken to plant these when the area nearby is deserted. Usually, but not always, this is done at night. These bombs are the pride and joy of Soviet boss Brezhnev because they incorporate technology that originated many years ago in his own rocket programs. In areas where the bottom is soft and silt-covered, these bombs are able to embed themselves in the silt. Under ideal test conditions in the Soviet Union, it was found that they were able to penetrate to depths as great as 80 feet. And there are a few locations in America, primarily in the lower Mississippi River, where depths that rival this may actually have been achieved operationally. Best of all, from the Soviet point of view, is their reliability. This system, by which the bomb practically blasts its way into the silt, by using a powerful jet of steam at temperatures above 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, uses no moving parts. The jet is started before the bomb is dropped in the water, And after that, it runs until the fuel is exhausted. The fuel itself, according to my own intelligence sources, is the oldest, most reliable, and cheapest of all rocket fuels. Highly concentrated hydrogen peroxide, which leaves no residue to be detected afterward. A third type of bomb that is now being used is a small general-purpose H-bomb, whose primary feature is compactness. A few of these have been planted in water, but these are mostly being used now in the newest phase of the Soviet nuclear mining program. First, Washington, D.C. was mined. All the bridges into Washington are now mined, as are important buildings throughout the city. These include the Capitol Building, Senate and House Office Buildings, the Executive Office Building, the Treasury Building, 7 bombs at Fort Myer, Virginia, the Pentagon, and even the White House itself, plus many other points, a total of 57 in the nation's capital. In addition, bombs have now been planted in at least 33 of the 50 state capitals. Congress, the president, and state governments have so far refused to act to protect the people, but now they themselves are being targeted, and symbols of our national pride and heritage in Washington are to be destroyed without a trace. Time does not permit a complete listing of even the nuclear devices in the Mississippi River, which now contains 158 bombs. As of my latest report on July 7, 1977, every lock in the Mississippi River, except number 2 at Hastings, Minnesota, now has a Soviet H-bomb in or near it. In addition, almost every bridge crossing the Mississippi along its entire length has a bomb planted at one end or the other as of that date, and it was anticipated that by now there would no longer be any exceptions. Thus, the Soviet Union plans to be able to cut the country in half, east to west, to anything but air transportation, which under war conditions will be totally controlled by the federal government under the provisions of Executive Orders 11490 and 11921. In addition, the Mississippi is to be ruined as a navigable waterway connecting north and south along the Mississippi Valley. And the master strategy that has been applied to the Mississippi has also been applied to the other great waterways of America, such as the Illinois Waterway and the Ohio River. Now, it remains only to trigger a declaration of national emergency, and after that, nuclear war won. When I recorded audio letter number 24 in May 1977, just 3 months ago, I warned that, quote, a horrendous new capability is now in place as an alternate means for creating our national emergency. And, my friends, there are ominous signs that this capability is going to be used very soon, unquote. I then gave the locations of 7 fission bombs planted strategically around the undersea trenches east and west of the Philippines, where they can trigger massive earthquakes and tidal waves. These 7 gigaton bombs are the most powerful weapons ever devised by man, and the disaster that erupts there is planned to work its way around the Ring of Fire to produce an artificial West Coast disaster centering on California that will be used to justify a declaration of national emergency. In the 3 months since I last spoke to you, the Soviet Union has also deployed 10 additional super bombs to assist in this diabolical attack on the Earth's crust itself. These are less powerful than the 7 doomsday bombs planted around the Philippines, but are extremely powerful nonetheless. These 10 new bombs are known as cobalt bombs, so called because they are surrounded by a jacket of cobalt. When the cobalt bomb was first proposed many years ago, it was universally feared and condemned because while it is less powerful than the gigaton bombs in the Philippines, it would be even dirtier in radioactive fallout if exploded in the air. Pound for pound, the radioactive cobalt-60 produced by the explosion emits 25 times as much deadly gamma radiation as radium. It decays relatively fast, with a half-life of just over 5 years. But if detonated in the air, some scientists believe the fallout could destroy all human life before the radiation decayed to harmless levels. But as with the uranium jacket gigaton bomb, the Soviet Union has found a way to use the cobalt bomb deep under the ocean for geophysical warfare. And having solved the dangerous problems involved in manufacturing and handling such weapons, the Soviet Union now has available an intermediate yield super bomb that is far cheaper than bombs made from uranium. Of the 10 Soviet cobalt bombs deployed so far, 9 are positioned along boundaries between the slowly shifting crustal plates that cover the surface of the Earth, while the 10th is targeted on a prime American naval target, Pearl Harbor. Their purpose is to produce a pattern of increasing earthquake and tidal wave activity as a build-up to the big disaster that awaits the Philippines. The 10 Soviet cobalt bombs were planted in the following locations. Number 1, 11 degrees, 8 minutes, 28 seconds south, 118, 32, 23 east. This is roughly 900 miles southeast of Jakarta, Indonesia, near the east end of the Java Trench, south of the islands of Sumba and Sumbawa. Number 2, 1100 south, 115, 834 east. This is around 370 miles west of location number 1, deep in the Java Trench, south of the islands of Bali and Sumbawa, Indonesia. Number 3, 1333 south, 149, 00 east. This is in the area of the Bismarck Archipelago, northeast of New Guinea. Number 4, 10579 south, 159, 30, 30 east. This is in the confluence of trenches southwest of Guadalcanal, 1,500 miles northeast of Australia. Number 5, 15, 52, 23 south, 172, 34, 50 west. This is in the north end of the Tonga Trench, little more than 100 miles southwest of Pago Pago, Samoa. Number 6, 12, 22, 51 north, 145, 40, 0 east. This is in the Marianas Trench, roughly 75 miles southeast of Guam. Number 7, 37, 35, 10 north, 144, 5, 20 east, in the Japan Trench, around 350 miles northeast of Tokyo. Number 8, 23, 25, 46 north, 108, 23, 14 west. This is in the deep central portion of the Gulf of California, between the southern tip of Baja California and the mainland of Mexico, and lies along the same crustal fault line that is known as the San Andreas Fault, where it passes through California. Number 9, 20, 0, 0 north, 73, 52, 16 west. This is in a short but deep trench off the east end of Cuba, and about 80 miles due east of the United States Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And finally, number 10, 20, 54, 28 north, 158, 48, 17 west. This is about 70 miles west-southwest of Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, the headquarters of the United States Pacific Fleet. The Soviet plan is to artificially create a seemingly natural but disturbing pattern of increasingly widespread earthquakes, primarily around the Pacific Rim. The stars of this preliminary show are to be these cobalt bombs in the oceans, but several artificial earthquakes on land are also to be triggered. One or more of these preliminary earthquakes on land may involve the collapse of a dam in the United States, adding fuel to the fire of publicity over supposedly unsafe federal dams. Finally, this buildup is to culminate in a supposed natural disaster in the Philippines, produced in reality by the triggering in proper sequence of the 7 Soviet gigaton bombs. If all goes according to plan, unprecedented earthquakes and awesome tidal waves will cause death and destruction in the Philippines on a scale unparalleled in modern history. And not incidentally, our major naval installations and the huge Clark Air Base in the Philippines will be destroyed. When it's all over, our naval and other military installations in Hawaii will also be gone, as will our Guantanamo naval base and important naval installations on America's west coast and in Japan. America will have been dealt a staggering military blow, but the only declaration by the United States government will not be one of war and retaliation, but only of national emergency, in effect suspending the remaining tatters of the United States Constitution. It all sounds too horrible to be true, my friends, but in actual fact, it has already begun. When I recorded audio letter number 24 3 months ago, there was no unusual earthquake activity going on. But based on intelligence made available only to me, I warned that this was about to change and soon. And just 1 week ago, on August 19, 1977, an undersea earthquake suddenly erupted just south of the Indonesian islands of Sumba and Sumbawa. The reports of damage and casualties are still filtering in today, 1 week later. But this quake was rated by some seismic readings as possibly the strongest quake ever recorded, registering 8.9 on the Richter scale. A tidal wave 100 feet high swept in from the south and washed away everyone and everything in its path. This quake, my friends, was produced by the detonation of the Soviet cobalt bomb number 1 in the list I just gave you. And, my friends, the Soviet Union is wasting no time now. Only this morning, just before I began the recording of this tape, Soviet cobalt bomb number 2 was detonated. The result this time was a less spectacular quake, according to first reports, centered south of Sumbawa and Bali, but with a reading of only 6.3 on the Richter scale. My friends, during the past 4.5 years, I've tried in every way I know to warn America in time for these and other man-made disasters to be prevented. But I am only a messenger, relaying vital information to you for which I myself cannot take the credit. What happens from here on is up to you, your neighbor, our country as a whole. But until and unless my voice is silenced by federal emergency regulations, war, or other factors beyond my control, I pledge to you to do all in my power to keep you fully informed about what is happening and where it is leading. Meanwhile, I can only urge you to continue to place yourself in the hands of God. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God protect each and every one of you.